here we go. All right, well, welcome everybody. The stalwarts are here till the end, and we are happy to be here for the final plenary workshop, and then stay tuned because Dr. Wharton will be presenting immediately after this session. So today's featured session is on viral vaccines, issues and challenges. Our first speaker is going to speak on measles epidemiology and vaccine policy. I'm sure some of you in the audience dealt with some measles outbreaks last year, and we continue to have importations, so Kathy will be discussing measles. Kathleen Gallagher is a Doctor of Science, MPH. She's the team leader for measles, mumps, rubella, and polio activities with the Epidemiology Branch, Division of Viral Diseases, in NCIRD, CDC. In that capacity, she's responsible for overseeing all activities related to the surveillance and investigation of measles, mumps, rubella, and polio. And despite the fact that these diseases are at very low levels, they keep us extremely busy, especially measles. So, Kathy.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for sticking around. Looks like there's about 100 of you here. This morning I'm going to talk about measles. We had a banner year for measles in 2008, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about the epidemiology of measles currently. I'll give you a little bit past history, and we'll talk a little bit of some of the things we can continue to do to be vigilant. So I've structured my talk this way for today. I'll give a brief background and history of measles. I'll talk a little bit about the burden of disease globally in the US in the pre-vaccine era. I'll talk about the current epidemiology of measles, focusing mostly on what's been going on in the US. I'll talk about challenges for maintaining elimination and strategies for moving forward in the future. So most of you probably are pretty familiar with measles. And you'll all know it's an acute viral illness that usually presents as a high fever, a maculopapular rash, and the three C's, cough, coryza, and conjunctivitis. And also frequently, cases will present with coplex spots, which are oral lesions that are pathognomonic for measles. Measles is of public health significance because it's extremely contagious, one of the most contagious diseases we know of. And in many cases, it causes severe complications, especially in people who may be immune compromised or malnourished. It causes complications like pneumonia, diarrhea, dehydration, and depending on the setting, the case fatality rate ranges from 0.1 to 15%. So before measles vaccine was around, in the earlier part of this century, measles was nearly a universal childhood disease, and some of you may remember having it. I know that I do. And it was thought that there were about 135 million cases and 6 million deaths each year that were due to measles. In the early 60s, a safe and effective vaccine for measles was developed and licensed in the US. And in the mid-1970s, a measles vaccine was incorporated into WHO's expanded program on immunization, and dramatic decreases in global disease burden occurred as a result of that. However, in 2000, it was still estimated that about 750 deaths were occurring worldwide from measles, most of this in Africa and Asia. So a group of partners formed what's called the Measles Initiative because they thought that this was still an unacceptably high rate of measles deaths worldwide, and they developed a goal to try to reduce measles mortality by 50% by the year 2005. And for any of you who know about these efforts, remarkably, this goal was achieved ahead of time and under budget. And so rather than just sort of celebrate their victory, they got even more aggressive, and there's a current goal now to reduce measles mortality worldwide by 90% by the year 2010. And in just a moment, I'll show you some slides that talk about progress in that regard. The key strategies really for achieving this goal are to improve case management for measles cases that are identified, to improve coverage with one dose of measles vaccine to offer second opportunities for measles immunization, which is not really routine in most countries, and to strengthen disease surveillance. This slide shows you some of the progress that has been made in measles vaccine coverage since this global goal was initiated earlier in this decade. And what I really want you to focus on is the bars at the far right, which are the global numbers. And it's estimated that in 2007, global one-dose measles vaccine coverage was 82%. There have also been remarkable accomplishments in the reduction in measles mortality worldwide. This slide shows you the different WHO regions, and then in the far column, the percent of reduction in deaths that have occurred over the past 7 years, or the 7 years between 2000 and 2007. And you can see that worldwide, there's been a 74% reduction in measles deaths. Again, a remarkable achievement. And what I think is also notable about this slide is that some of the WHO regions, particularly the Eastern Mediterranean and African regions, have either already met this 90% reduction goal or are close to meeting them. Okay, there's a $100 reward for anyone who can name this kid, because every CDC presentation on measles shows this kid. And I think the kid should probably be getting royalties. I don't know where he is, but. So in the US, before the introduction of vaccine, we had about 500,000 cases of measles that were reported every year. But in fact, we think because of its infectious nature, probably the entire birth cohort was affected every year. So probably in reality, there were 3 to 4 million cases of measles every year. And in that era, severe complications for measles were quite common. And we would expect about 150,000 persons who would have respiratory complications, primarily pneumonia, 4,000 cases annually of measles-associated encephalitis. Many of these would result in long-term sequelae, 48,000 hospitalizations, and 450 deaths. So measles was a significant problem in the US in the pre-vaccine era. Thus the effort on, you know, vaccine development. So as many of you know, there was a the first vaccine licensed for measles in the US was licensed in 1963. It was incorporated into the routine childhood immunization schedule shortly after that. And as you can see from this slide, by the end of that decade, there had already been remarkable declines and measles incidence in the United States. And as a matter of fact, by 1966, just 3 years after the vaccine was licensed, the first efforts at measles elimination were started in the United States. And we were actually doing quite well until this little bump happened in 1989 and 91, which was this resurgence of measles that some of you may remember. It occurred between 1989 and 1991. There were about 55,000 cases that occurred during that period, 123 reported deaths. And many of these cases were in unimmunized toddlers who had missed opportunities for their first MMR vaccine, and also cases where there was primary vaccine failure in people who had already received a single dose of vaccine. So in 1989, many of you will remember, there was a two-dose schedule that was recommended and implemented, and then we continue to see declines in measles incidence through the 90s. And as you'll see on this slide, beginning in 1997, the incidence of measles in the US was less than one case per million. And by the year 2000, we had declared measles eliminated in the US, which was a remarkable public health success. And what that basically means is not that there are no cases of measles that occur, but that the endemic transmission of measles in the US had been stopped. So what's been happening to measles since we declared elimination? Well, as I alluded to, we've had importations every year, and some spread from those importations, but the number of cases has really been fairly low, with an average of 63 reported cases each year. And most of these cases were related to an imported case, which means a person from either the U.S. or a foreign citizen who was traveling abroad and then brought measles back into the country. Some of these were from people traveling to developed countries like Europe and Japan, and as well as developing countries. And we'll talk more when we talk about the current epidemiology of where the importations for measles are coming from now. In this post-elimination era, most of the outbreaks predominated in unprotected populations. So 2008, right around just when I started working in the measles program, we had something changed, and we had a very large number of measles cases all of a sudden being reported, the highest number reported since 1996, and this increased number didn't appear to be related to increased in importations. As a matter of fact, I'll show you some data about that, which supports that. But it seemed to be related to increased spread within the U.S. with 7 outbreaks. We were busy reporting on these last year. These are the 3 MMWRs published in 2008 that summarize these outbreaks last year. And as a result, there was a lot of media attention around measles last year, which I think was good because it served to highlight that measles is still around and people still need to be vigilant. So there were 140 cases in total last year. 19 states and the District of Columbia reported cases. 12% of these cases were hospitalized. Fortunately, there were no deaths. We had 24 importations last year. 13 of those were in foreign visitors who were traveling to the U.S. for either business or pleasure. 11 of those were in U.S. residents who were returning from travels abroad. And all of these importations were in people who were unvaccinated. Another 102 cases were epidemiologically or virologically linked to these importations, and a handful of cases, about 14 cases, had an unknown source of infection but were most likely linked to some sort of importation that we just could not identify. 127 of these cases were in U.S. residents, and 91% of these U.S. residents were unvaccinated. This map just shows you that basically these measles cases and outbreaks were occurring all over the United States. The yellow dots here represent the sporadic cases of measles, and the larger pink dots represent the 7 outbreaks that occurred in the United States. You can see that there were fairly substantial outbreaks in Washington State, California, Arizona, Illinois, and New York City, as evidenced by the size of those dots. So I talked before about how the increased number of measles cases in 2008 wasn't related to just an increased number of imports. If you look at these bar charts, the orange portion of the chart is the number of cases that are direct importations. And you can see that number is actually low in 2008. It was 17%. This is the lowest percentage of imported cases, directly imported cases, we've had in the U.S. since 1996. So the blue bar on here represents all of those cases that were a result of spread from those imported cases. And you can see that was the greatest proportion of cases during 2008. So where are these importations coming from? This map shows you the paths of transmission from different countries to the U.S. with regard to these importations. And what's most notable about this slide, I think, is you can follow the dotted end of the arrow and see that the majority of these importations are coming from Europe, or at least the WHO European region. During 2008, we had multiple importations from Belgium, Switzerland, Italy, and Israel into the U.S. And you'll see we had a few importations from Asia, but again, the majority from Europe, and mostly from developed countries. Most of the measles cases reported last year were in children and adolescents. As you can see from this slide, 80% of cases were less than 20 years of age. Of note, there were 17 cases last year in infants under the age of 12 months. These are kids that aren't recommended to receive vaccine at this time and who count on the herd protection of others to prevent them from getting measles. This slide shows you the reported reasons for not being vaccinated among the 116 unvaccinated U.S. residents with measles. So I'll take a minute to just go over this. You can see we have these 17 kids who are too young to be vaccinated. Those are the kids less than 12 months of age. We had one person who was born before 1957. We generally consider those people immune, so they aren't routinely recommended to get vaccinated. We had 31 cases in which there was a missed opportunity or vaccination was delayed. These were mostly kids in the 12 to 15 month age group whose parents were delaying or deferring vaccination, but didn't have any objection per se to vaccinating their child at some point. And then the vast majority, 57% in this reddish-brown portion of the pie, were children whose parents had personal or religious beliefs that prevented them from vaccinating their children. Another thing notably different about measles in 2008 is shown on this slide. This slide focuses on kids who are school-aged, 5 to 19 years of age, and the percentage of those who claimed personal belief exemption among the measles cases. And in 2008, in excess of 90% of school-aged children with measles were unvaccinated because of personal or religious beliefs. The only other notable point on this slide is 2005, and there was actually a large outbreak in Indiana of measles also associated with personal belief exemptions that accounts for that peak as well. But during the rest of this time period, you can see the number of people claiming personal belief exemptions is low. During 2008, some of you in this crowd are well aware that there were three large outbreaks associated with unvaccinated school children. One of these was in San Diego. I think there's been a lot of press about this particular outbreak. There were a total of 12 cases. A lot of them were focused in one particular school. There was a large outbreak in Washington State involving 19 kids, in 19 cases, 16 of whom were school-aged children. And in Illinois, there was an outbreak over the summer of 30 cases involving 25 school-aged children. And the things that were common to all these outbreaks were that they were, a lot of the transmission was associated, we think, with school or school-related activities. In some cases in Washington State, they were homeschooled kids, but they for sure had other activities within the community. And most of the kids involved in this outbreak were members of families that had personal belief exemptions to measles. So how does what we saw as far as morbidity for measles in 2008 correspond to what we know about measles vaccine coverage in the U.S.? This slide you've probably seen before. This is estimated MMR vaccine coverage for children aged 19 to 35 months. And if you look over time or in the recent past, coverage overall in the U.S. is high, over 92%. And if we look at specific coverage rates for the three states that were involved in those three large outbreaks, California, Washington, and Illinois, we'll also see that coverage was high, 95%, 85%, and 93%. And if we look at the kindergarten surveys, which measure two-dose coverage, we'll also see that coverage is high. So, you know, maybe 2008 was just a fluke. But then we saw this map, which was done by colleagues in San Diego as part of their investigation of the San Diego measles outbreak. And what they did is they actually took data from each individual school and they looked at exemption rates. And then they mapped them on this map of San Diego County. So the shaded areas are the school districts, And the gradient of color on those in those school districts is the school district specific exemption rate. You can see ranging from zero if it's white to between 5% and 20% if it's the sort of medium dark blue. The yellow dots are the exemption specific numbers for each school within these school districts. And what you can see from this slide is that there are quite a few schools that have exemption rates in excess of 20%, as seen by the largest of the yellow dots. And you can also see that if you were to only look at school district specific exemption rates, you might not notice this because many of these schools are in these areas that have this light blue shading in the school district, where it would suggest that there was maybe up to 2.5% exemption rates. So when I saw this slide, I mean, this really gave me pause that there are likely pockets of unimmunized children around the U.S. that might be susceptible to measles. So in summary, during 2008, the U.S. saw the largest number of measles cases it had seen in over a decade. The epidemiology was characterized by a high proportion of cases among U.S. residents who were unvaccinated. Many of these were school-aged children who had claimed exemptions for vaccination, and many of the children in 2008 at least were homeschooled. It was also a year where we saw more spread from imported cases than we had in the post-elimination era. So you might ask, okay, that was 2008, what's going on in 2009? Well, 2009 luckily has been sort of slow until this week, so that's the way sort of it always happens. I think some of you here may have been on teleconference or maybe you had to go home early to deal with some reported measles cases. But as of the end of last week, there were only 9 cases reported throughout the U.S. And all of these cases were import associated. 7 of them were direct imports and 2 of them were import linked. I've listed here the countries that they were imported from. The most notable thing here is that recently, we've been seeing a lot of importations to the UK from the UK. And this is important because when people travel to the UK, even though it's a recommendation that we have that all travelers, regardless of international location, be up to date on MMR, people don't think about getting vaccinated when they travel to Europe. Globally, I talked before about some of the achievements in measles control and elimination, which have been remarkable. Most of those have been in developing countries. In 2008, measles outbreaks have abounded in Europe, and many of you may have heard that the United Kingdom, which basically was operating like us in an era of measles elimination, last year had to declare that measles had been reestablished endemically in their country. Over 1,400 cases were reported from the UK last year, over 2,000 from Switzerland. So travel to Europe and trying to prevent importations from travel to Europe will be a challenge that we'll need to address. So given that we have 30 million US residents traveling abroad each year, 50 million or so international travelers, I think we can count on having future measles importations into the US. I put this slide up because it illustrates the point that measles is occurring in countries that we wouldn't necessarily think about. So if to orient you to this map, these countries in Europe are color-coded according to their income level, with the low-income countries or the lowest-income countries in red and pink, and the higher-income countries in green. You'll see that the measles outbreaks that have been occurring recently have been in the high-income countries in Europe. And again, this is important that when you think about traveling internationally, people frequently don't think at all about getting any immunizations for travel when they're going to Europe. But they would be quite aware of it if they were going to a more developing country. So what are our challenges for maintaining measles elimination in the U.S.? I think we are all convinced that there's going to be ongoing risks of importation. I think a real challenge is the lack of familiarity among travelers, the public, and healthcare providers about measles. Many healthcare providers have not seen a case of measles ever, or if they did, it was a long time ago. So there's a lot of delayed diagnosis that may make follow-up more difficult. When there is a measles case identified, as you are all well aware, there's a tremendous amount of effort that is effort and public health response that goes into following up and investigating these cases. And depending on how much transmission there is, that can be incredibly difficult to sustain a response. And then maintaining high two-dose vaccination coverage is also challenging, especially in an era where there's less perception about the severity of disease and increased concern about vaccine safety. So what do we do to maintain measles elimination? Well, I think we sort of have to keep doing what we're doing, and we're doing a good job of it. We have to just maintain our surveillance. We have to do rapid outbreak response, which, again, I think we're doing a pretty good job of, and we need to maintain high two-dose coverage. For the future, I think, again, we need to constantly monitor what our MMR vaccine coverage is, monitor the impact of vaccine exemptions and understand the reasons for these exemptions, and increase awareness for measles with the public, healthcare providers, and travelers, especially those to highly developed countries. I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues in the CDC and state and local health departments, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Kathy. I think we've got a few minutes for questions. We got any? Got somebody coming up? Dr. Zimmerman.
Chris Zimmerman from New York City. Do you see sort of 2008 as an issue of rising personal belief exemption, which I think we're all concerned about, or is it just that while we haven't seen more importations, where the importations are coming from is introducing measles into communities where we previously hadn't been seeing that, and it's identifying what was out there. So the PBEs really hasn't changed. It's really the changing epi of where the importations come from in the communities. And to follow up on that, do you guys foresee any changes in travel recommendations, regulations that would help protect us from Western Europe?
Those people in Europe. I'll answer, I guess there are two questions there. So the first one is, I don't think we have really good data for personal belief exemption rates over time in a granular enough fashion to know where they might be occurring. Undoubtedly, there have been these pockets of unimmunized before. So I don't think this is an entirely new phenomenon. And part of what happened in 2008 was there were people who were unvaccinated in these communities of kids who traveled to Europe and came back from their vacation unimmunized. So part of that is just bad luck. I think one of the messages we're trying to get out related to your second point is that it's hard to know how to reach travelers who are going to countries that aren't perceived at risk for disease. Because I know myself, the last time I went to Europe, I don't remember going to the CDC travel webpage to see what vaccines I needed. I just assumed I didn't need any. And so part of what we need to do, I think, is try to get the word out more about making sure that the recommendations for foreign travel are applied universally for all countries. So we actually, about a month ago, posted something on the CDC travel webpage about that. But again, if you don't go to the CDC travel webpage, you won't see that. One of the other conversations I had recently is with someone who is associated with the medical directors for airlines. And it seems to me that we could try to be creative about some messaging there where You know, if you go to the Delta website when you buy your ticket and it says something about getting vaccinated, you know, you might actually do something about it. So I think we have to sort of explore creative ways to get that vaccination message out. We already recommend that people who travel anywhere internationally get their, be up to date on their MMR. So I don't know that we'll change that, but I think we have to do a better job of communicating that message.
Actually, I'm Alice Dubon. I'm also from New York, but Putnam County. So specifically, if somebody did call me and say, you know, I'm going to London and should I get an MMR, if they were born before 1957 or people in my age cohort had one measles vaccine, would you recommend that they come in and get one or two MMRs before they travel?
Well, we still consider people born before 57 to be immune, although clearly that's not 100%. People who are traveling to Europe or anywhere else who are not born before 57 and don't have any other proof of immunity, we consider proof of immunity two doses of MMR. And also, I think another point is that for infants ages 6 to 11 months, it's recommended that they also get a single dose of MMR before travel.
Thanks. We've got a couple more seconds.
Okay, hello, I'm Albert Hoffenhoek from the Health Protection Agency in England. Oh. And indeed, we have problems with with measles, and it's all because of low uptake of MMR. You showed in your presentation that the influx of measles cases is stable in 2008, but there was a high spread of measles in the community. So the highest risk is not influx from Europe, but a group of susceptibles here in the US. So the main focus, I think, should be get rid of this group of susceptibles instead of focusing on your travelers. What kind of initiatives does the CDC take to look for those groups of susceptibles and increase the MMR coverage in those groups?
Mm-hmm. I guess you're right. We had more spread in 2008, but we're still going to emphasize our travel recommendations for vaccination regardless. As far as looking for those pockets of unimmunized kids, I think actually a lot of this data is available from state and local health departments who frequently have surveys done in schools because CDC does a kindergarten survey every year, and there's different variability in how states may do that. But basically, we assess, each state has an assessment of coverage in kindergartens, some of them in all schools, some of them in just a subset of schools. So I think at the local level, it might be easier to identify these pockets. And I think you're right, it's important for us to be able to measure where that is and target interventions, if appropriate and necessary, to those groups.
I don't think we've got time for any more questions. I just would add that, you know, as a center, we're very committed to trying to understand the trends in vaccine exemption and improving methods for measuring in schools. I'd also comment that, you know, 85% coverage in Washington, we'd like to see that to be a little bit higher. So maintaining high coverage, as Kathy said, is really important.